don't think it's as dire as, you know, you'll see stocks start being depleted on the shelves, but it could conceivably happen if the volcano doesn't quiet down.
Readout takes its toll on cargo operations in Anchorage. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 30th of March. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, managing a tough fishing problem in the Bering Sea.
Chinook associate with pollock, and it's very difficult to separate them completely. Some years it's easier, and some years it's not.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Association of Alaska School Boards. Their mission is to advocate for children and youth by assisting school boards to provide quality public education, supporting student achievement and local governance. Information at aasb.org.
Alaska Airlines canceled more flights today as Mount Readout produced new ash clouds. The Alaska Volcano Observatory reported several short, relatively low-altitude explosions from the volcano today that sent plumes as high as 27,000 feet. The National Weather Service did not issue any ashfall advisories, but the ash clouds were big enough to affect air travel. Paul McElroy is a spokesman for Alaska Airlines. He says the company is constantly reevaluating the safety hazard.
Just as soon as we started canceling some flights, then the ash looked like it was not going to pose a hazard. And so now, again, we've decided, well, we'll just monitor the situation every hour, try to run a limited schedule, and get as many of our customers on their way as we can.
Alaska Airlines has canceled about 250 flights since Readout began erupting last week. McElroy says 10,000 passengers have been affected.
When you go up against Mother Nature, it's a contest that we can't win.
McElroy says Alaska Airlines is trying to clear up the backlog of passengers, but is having a hard time because it can't even operate on a normal schedule. He says the airline will try to schedule extra flights to accommodate passengers as soon as possible. The erupting volcano has also severely hampered cargo operations in Anchorage. The two largest cargo operators at the airport, FedEx and UPS, are sending most of their flights to and from Asia through the lower 48 instead. UPS Public Relations Manager Mike Manjo says the company is routing flights through Seattle, Portland, and Honolulu.
You know, Mount Readout has certainly impacted our cargo operations, but we're doing our best to work around the challenges Mother Nature has put before us.
FedEx calls Anchorage its gateway hub to the Far East. It would normally send about 150 flights a week through the airport. Most are now going through Oakland instead. The reroutings cost the company in extra fuel and lost cargo space. Dennis Mitchell is vice president for Linden International in Alaska. He estimates about 70% of their cargo forwarding business has been disrupted this week because of the volcano. He says it's frustrating, but there's not much to be done about it.
The reason people use air freight is because it's a just-in-time delivery process that has some impact on their operations, whether it's retail or oil patch. People use air freight because they need it there immediately. And when the planes aren't flying, it's a little tough.
Mitchell says the volcano has had an especially devastating impact on getting fresh halibut to the lower 48. That season opened March 21st, the day before Readout first blew. Mitchell says retailers in Alaska also depend a lot on air freight to move products into the state, and that supply chain has been severely disrupted.
A lot of that stuff comes air, so shelves don't get stocked. I don't think it's as dire as, you know, you'll see stocks start being depleted on the shelves, but, you know, it could conceivably happen if the volcano doesn't quiet down.
A group comprised of state, federal, and Cook Inlet pipeline staff have formed a unified command under the supervision of Coast Guard Commander Joe Lusciuto to develop a plan for the Drift River crude oil facility located at the base of Mount Readout. Lusciuto is the federal on-scene coordinator for the Readout response. He says the unified command is looking at options for safely removing some oil from the two tanks at Drift River that currently have more than 6 million gallons of crude in them.
Removing some part of the oil is the number one proposal that's being looked at right now.
Loschuto says the decision must take into consideration whether removing the oil will impact stability for the tanks. Loschuto had just returned from a site visit to Drift River this afternoon. He says they were on the ground for about an hour and then had to leave because of another readout eruption. He says there is no apparent oil pollution and pressure is being maintained in the lines, which he says indicates there is probably no leaking from the system.
We're in a good, safe position. Let's stay there while we really get the answers to all the questions we have, and then we can effectively move forward with a solution that's safe for all the people and, just as important, safe for the environment and safe for Cook Inlet.
Asking for immediate action to protect Cook Inlet from a possible spill from the Drift River facility, the law firm Trustees for Alaska wrote to Governor Sarah Palin on Friday, urging her to take action and insisting that the tanks be drawn down. The letter was written on behalf of Cook Inlet Keeper. Bob Shavelson is the director of Cook Inlet Keeper. He says beyond the call for immediate action, they want the facility moved because it remains in harm's way.
And we really think we need to think carefully after this seismic event, whether we want to continue to have a tank farm at the base of an active volcano.
Shavelson says the response to formulating a plan for the Drift River facility has been slow. He likened it to the initial response to the Exxon Valdez oil spill disaster.
It took almost a week after the eruption for the responsible agencies to set up what's called a unified command structure needed to address a spill, and there's not enough spill response equipment in Cook Inlet to clean up 6 million gallons. So it's deja vu all over again, and we're just keeping our fingers crossed.
Commander Loschuto says there are only 4 or 5 vessels in the area that can get into the Drift River terminal. He says one has been identified as a possibility for offloading the Drift River tanks. Governor Sarah Palin has selected a high-ranking legislative employee as the next state senator representing Juneau. Tim Grusendorf has been appointed to the seat made vacant when Kim Elton left for Washington, D.C. to work for the U.S. Department of Interior. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
Tim Grusendorf currently works as chief of staff to Bethel Democrat Lyman Hoffman, the co-chair of the Senate Finance Committee. The son of former House Speaker Ben Grusendorf, the senator-designee has worked as a commercial fisherman and is active within the fishing community. The governor's action rejects Representative Beth Gertula, the only choice of the local Democratic Party. Grusendorf ran for the District 4 House seat as a Democrat in 2002, but was defeated by Republican Bruce Weirach. His affiliation changed to Republican after that, until last month when he switched his party affiliation back to Democrat. In making the appointment, Governor Palin said that Grusendorf has a good understanding of the issues facing the state and facing Juneau, adding that he can hit the ground running when his appointment is confirmed by the remaining Senate Democrats. There's no word yet on when that confirmation vote will take place. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Grusendorf was one of 4 people interviewed by the governor for the Senate District B seat. He says he's not surprised she selected him. He thinks he answered the questions just the way Palin wanted.
I knew there was a very good chance that she'd select me, and I felt really good walking out of that interview that the questions she asked me seemed to be right along the lines of where I was at. I thought I fit the bill that she was looking for pretty well. They were broad questions. There were questions that relating to Juneau, industry-wise, road-wise, my support for ANWR, you know, the opening of responsible exploration of ANWR, all of which, you know, I support.
Grusendorf calls himself a conservative Democrat who believes in resource development, particularly the Kensington Gold Mine, is the ticket to Juneau's economic future. He says he can hit the ground running because of his 14 years' experience working as a staff member in the Senate. Gertula also was interviewed by Palin. She's taking a gracious look at what the party is calling a snub. Gertula says Juneau representation in the Senate trumps anyone's personal feelings.
At the end of the day, we're going to work with whomever gets that seat, and I'm going to put my head down and get through this session and do the very best I can to get some, you know, good results for Juneau. And, you know, I fully realize that if I decide to run for that Senate seat, I can go file and earn it the old-fashioned way.
Juneau Democratic Party officials are lobbying Senate Democrats to reject Grusendorf's nomination to the Senate seat. Rich Listuszewski is Central Committee spokesman for the Greater Juneau Democratic District. He says local Democrats are asking party members statewide to help derail the appointment. He says Juneau party officials have never been contacted by anyone in the governor's office since the replacement process began.
Nobody. She has never communicated with the Juneau Democratic Party.
On March 5th, local Democrats forwarded Beth Kurtula's name for the Senate appointment to Governor Palin. On the 9th, Palin sent out a news release saying she would start her own process because she wanted more candidates. Grusendorf was dropped from consideration by the Democrats because he had not been a registered Democrat for a full year, one of the local Democrats' requirements, though it is not a qualification in state law. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Bethel celebrates Chiang Mai with an international lineup of dancers.
That was cool.
It was awesome. Good.
He did all these flips and things that normal people can't do.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska Fairbanks now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
Washington state legislators are considering levying a 37.5 cents a gallon tax on refined blended fuel exported to other states, including Alaska. That would affect some 30 million gallons of fuel coming into the state, and Alaska's legislators are fighting back.
Well, it has a huge impact. Most of the fuel comes into southeast, but certainly a lot of it into western Alaska, and they shouldn't be paying more.
That's House Speaker Mike Chenault, who today introduced a bill that would tax all crude oil sent to Washington refineries, where about 70% of Alaska production is sent. He says his bill is a signal that the state wants to have a conversation with Washington lawmakers to make sure they understand the effects of their tax proposal.
I don't want to start a war, but certainly I wasn't the one that threw the first bill out there either. This is not the avenue that we think that they should go forward with to balance their budget, not on the backs of Alaska citizens.
But Washington faces a $9 billion deficit this year. The new tax on exported fuel is sponsored by Representative Jim Moeller from West Vancouver. He says his state is looking for new revenue, and there's a focus on transportation and exports.
There actually seems to be a few dollars there that we can help keep people working and help build some of our infrastructure up so that when the economy does turn around, we can actually be in a position to take advantage of that.
The tax is not an entirely new idea. About 3 years ago, Washington legislators attempted to pass a similar bill that would add a tax to exported cargo containers. Haines Republican Bill Thomas and Juneau Democrat Beth Kurtula pushed back and stopped the bill that could have cost Alaska as much as $66 million per year. The North Pacific Fisheries Management Council is convening this week in Anchorage to tackle the thorny issue of Chinook salmon bycatch within the Bering Sea pollock industry. The council will consider implementing a cap on king bycatch, beyond which pollock fishing would be curtailed or shut down. Paul Korchin from KNOM reports.
Nome's Charlie Lean is director of the Fisheries Division for Norton Sound Economic Development Corporation and says they have a big stake in the issue.
The conundrum that our board has, the NSCDC board is faced with, is that pollock is one of our bread and butter fisheries. It's responsible for more than half our revenue, I think. So we don't want to see our pollock opportunity reduced greatly. On the other hand, we have some of the most critically reduced Chinook harvests in all of Bering Sea. We think we do a lot of good works with our money. We plow a great deal of our revenue back into the region in one way or another.
NSEDC is one of six community development quota groups in Western Alaska, which are each allotted a valuable percentage of the massive pollock fishery, worth roughly $1 billion annually. Pollock is a plentiful white fish that ends up in everything from imitation crab to filet-o-fish sandwiches. The trouble, Lean says, is the company the fish keep.
Chinook associate with pollock. Pollock are a bottom fish. They're a cod fish. King salmon eat pollock and some of the same species. So they're in close association, and it's very difficult to separate them completely. Some years it's easier, and some years it's not.
Chinook bycatch spiked at 122,000 fish a couple of years ago, and that's led to calls for stricter bycatch regulations. Some believe a low cap is the answer. The Bering Sea Fishermen's Association, for instance, is arguing for a bycatch limit of about 32,000 kings. BSFA Director Karen Gillis says recent trends suggest there's little room for regulatory leniency.
From 2000 to 2007, the average catches of Chinook salmon in Western Alaska decreased substantially compared to the previous decade. So for the Norton Sound region, the decline of the catches for Chinook salmon is 61%. For the Yukon River, it's 47%. And for the Kuskokwim, 41%. It would be safe to say that any returning Chinook is important. Chinook salmon are the most prized among all the fish species throughout the entire North Pacific by subsistence, commercial, and sport users alike. So we should be doing everything we can to keep bycatch as low as possible.
Gillis says it's not simply organizations like hers that want to see a low cap.
We did recently distribute a newsletter we send out periodically, The Fair Advocate, and the focus, the entire focus of the advocate for the March issue was Chinook salmon bycatch related. And the response to that from individuals within the AYK and Bristol Bay was incredible.
Others favor a higher cap. NSEDC is arguing for a Chinook bycatch limit of 47,500 fish. Lean says that falls in the middle of the options being considered by the council.
High number caps like 87,000 we felt were just over the top high. The low numbers like in the 30,000 range, we were worried that they might actually have the inverse effect from what was intended. When you put really strict limits on a commercial fishery, what happens is that if the fleet believes that it's an impossible goal, rather than trying to avoid Chinook, there's going to be those bad actors within the fleet that go, gee, there's no way we're going to hit that low goal. And so I better make hay while the sun shines. I'm going to go out there, I'm going to put all the big boat and nets in there, and I'm just going to catch as many fish as I can in the short term so that I increase my share over those people that are trying to be the good guy. We were not interested in creating a horse race for fish.
Whatever happens this week, Gillis says they're looking for a long-term and equitable response to the problem.
Commercial fisheries have been shut down. Subsistence fisheries have been restricted and sometimes, literally closed, so that these Chinook salmon can meet their minimum escapement goals. If these individuals whose lifeblood are these salmon have to conserve and reduce their use, it only makes sense to share that burden with the pollock industry.
The North Pacific Council meets at the Anchorage Hilton through April 7th. Public in-person testimony is being accepted. In Nome, I'm Paul Korchin.
Senator Lisa Murkowski plans to introduce legislation this week that would establish a national volcano monitoring system. It would include the Alaska Volcano Observatory in Anchorage and Fairbanks. Murkowski announced her intentions on the Senate floor in Washington today. She warned that the U.S. Geological Survey's Volcano Hazards Program is constantly underfunded.
It's because of the inadequate funding and critical importance of this program that I intend to introduce a bill that will provide the funding stability that volcano monitoring needs. This program shows that with a modest investment, a very large benefit can be produced in reducing the impacts of catastrophic events.
Murkowski says her bill would establish a national early warning and monitoring system within the U.S. Geological Survey. Just last month, funding for volcano monitoring came under a high-profile public attack when Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal criticized it during a primetime speech. Jindal delivered the Republican response to President Obama's first address to Congress and criticized funding in the economic stimulus package for, quote, something called volcano monitoring. On the Senate floor today, Murkowski referenced the debate over Jindal's comments.
I think we're all aware that there have been some recent comments made about federal spending for volcano monitoring and the suggestion that perhaps this might be wasteful money. that we don't have any need to be monitoring volcanoes. And I can assure you, Mr. President, that monitoring volcanoes is critically important to the nation, to the world, and particularly to Alaska right now, where, as I say, we are being held hostage by a volcano.
Murkowski's bill to establish a volcano monitoring system will be introduced in the Senate later this week. It would authorize funding the system at $15 million annually.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
This week saw the conclusion of Sharing Our Knowledge, a conference of Tlingit tribes and clans. Last week, hundreds of Alaska Native leaders, scholars, and elders gathered in Centennial Hall to learn about Tlingit people and culture. Renowned artist, author, and art historian Bill Holm was among the nearly 100 presenters this year. KTOO's Rebecca Shear has more.
As we learn in these clan conferences, respect for our elders is a number one Tlingit virtue. So to show respect to our elder, please welcome Bill Holm.
Anthropologist Sergei Khan may describe Bill Holm as an elder, but with twinkling blue eyes and a mop top of snow-white hair, the Northwest Coast art scholar says he's never thought of himself that way. Until recently.
I did have a birthday just a couple days ago, and that brought to my mind that I'm pretty much an elder.
May I ask what birthday it was?
Yeah, it's 84.
84. 84 years young, Bill Holm.
Well, I still like to feel young, but I'm beginning to realize that the time moves on.
Not that Holm hasn't made the most of his time. He's published 8 acclaimed books, including the 1965 classic Northwest Coast Indian Art, An Analysis of Form. He's nabbed countless awards and is a professor and curator emeritus at Seattle's Burke Museum of Natural History and Culture. In 2003, he lent his namesake to the museum's Bill Holm Center, one of the premier resources for the study of Pacific Northwest Coast Native art, a subject he got hooked on more than 70 birthdays ago when he moved from his native Roundup, Montana to Seattle.
When I was in the 9th grade, I became a technical advisor for a play that the 7th grade art class was giving. And I did some research over in the museum and borrowed some things. In those days, it was easier to borrow from museums than it is now. And really began my interest in the Northwest Coast.
Since then, Holm says most of his contact with Native people and culture has been on Vancouver Island, but he's definitely dabbled in Alaska.
Way back in the early 60s, probably about 1960, I came up to Port Chilkoot to teach in Carl Hein Miller's program there and met a lot of people, some I've seen here in the last couple of days.
Not that Holmes had a whole lot of time to socialize. He gave 2 talks at this year's Clan Conference, one titled The Head Canoe, the historical record of an archaic vessel, and a PowerPoint presentation called Old Photos Might Not Lie.
But they fib a lot about color. There's an old saying that photographs don't lie. Today it's common knowledge that they can lie a lot, even without photoshopping.
As Holm explains, 19th century photographs were made with materials, or emulsions, that were limited in their response to light. The earliest emulsions, what he calls panchromatic or blue-sensitive, had a heck of a time with reds and yellows, for instance, which would turn gray or black once the photo was developed.
On the other hand, the early emulsions were very sensitive to blue, so blue colors were printed as very light, even white.
So say an art historian or an anthropologist has an item of some sort and wants to determine where, when, and how that piece was used.
The problem is finding matches between old photographs and the same pieces today. This picture of a Tlingit man includes a great example. You see, he has a beaded collar. Well, in the center is a color photograph of the same collar. On the right is a panchromatic image of the same one. You can see how the blue-sensitive film has distorted the values.
Holm delivered his talk to a room packed with admirers, students, and fans, all of them excited to see this man whose given Indian name means plenty of everything.
I think if we learn something, among other things, at this conference, that Bill Holm can still teach us so much. So I'd like to give him another round of applause.
I'm gratified to know that a lot of Native people enjoy the things that I've done and have appreciated what I've done. And I'm retired officially, but I still continue to get around and see people and talk to people about these subjects.
And many people hope Bill Holm will keep doing so for many years and birthdays to come. In Juneau, I'm Rebecca Shear.
The Chamai Dance Festival wrapped up in Bethel Sunday night. The three-day event featured more than 20 dance groups from the YK Delta to Japan. KYUK's Shane Iverson has more.
The Chamai Dance Festival is on its 17th year. It started out as an event to pull together Yupik dancers from across the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. Maurice Nanaluk is singing with the Kuskokwim campus dancers. He's been teaching the college students songs from around the region.
Just about all different places from around here, a couple songs that I composed myself also. Chivak, for sure, was one of them. Scammon Bay. My mind's a blank right now.
Nanaluk is mentally and physically exhausted. He's become a common figure at Chamai by performing and drumming with about half a dozen groups.
Whoever needs my help most, I'm up there.
The festival was spiced up with some international flair. A group of Sudanese dancers took to the stage wearing striking traditional clothing.
My name is Tor. It's good for other people to know different culture as well. Even though we hear and we see different people, how they dance and how they perform their dance.
The dancers are from the same clan known as Nuer. They have been living in Anchorage for about 3.5 years. They keep busy with their traditional dances. Men wear white knee-length garments and had large, bright yellow tassels tied to their elbows. The women in the group wore brightly colored pattern dresses and skirts with brown tasseled balls tied around their waists.
We have line running, and that's what you guys have been seeing in there. Women came with different line, and then they dance differently than men, and that's what we just try different step because we have so many steps that we perform.
At Chamai, Tor was exposed to the regional dialect of Yupik. He reciprocated with his own language called Nuer. Tor says his translation means Bethel is a good community and they enjoy being here and enjoy seeing different cultures. At any Chamai, the front rows are left clear of seats so that kids can get an up-close view of the action from the floor. Their favorite was Static Elements, a breakdancing group from Anchorage.
That was cool.
It was awesome. Good.
They did all these flips and things that normal people can't do.
My name is Sai. I'm the leader of this group. It's the people out there that makes us want to dance. Yes. It's how loud they root for us, that it energizes us, so that we can do what we do out there. Yes. Oh, that's called the flare windmills. Flare windmills, flare windmills, flare windmills, flare. It's a combination, and that always gets the crowd.
Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Rosemary Alexander and Rebecca Shear in Juneau, Paul Korchin in Nome, and Shane Iverson and Alice Criswell in Bethel. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Fight. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Comfort Suites Anchorage International Airport. Comfort Suites, an all-suites hotel, is now open with a 24-hour shuttle service, indoor pool, and high-speed internet access. Reservations at 243-8080. And by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.